Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Why not listen to me, Mike Gawley, and Thomas Bryan, co-host of No Labels, the show for, by, and about issues, barriers, and solutions affecting the disability community in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Every episode focuses on accessibility news and views relevant to our community. That's No Labels with Thomas Bryan and Mike Gawley, playing regularly across the Access Radio network. Hello and welcome, I'm Mike Gawley. On today's show, we reflect on the First World War and its impact on Allied soldiers. But first up, the New Zealand Festival of the Arts finishes this month. And thanks to successful lobbying by disability activists, it supported a suite of access provisions. In charge of all that was Helen Vivian Fletcher.
So I'm one of the access producers. We've been booking the accessible shows, so NZSL, audio description, touch tours, relaxed performances, and also just providing information about all of the shows, whether they have specific accessible features or not.
So what are we talking about? We're talking about the accessible features. What's the suite of them?
So we have NZSL interpreted shows. We also have one NZ integrated show, which means there's a deaf performer on stage with the hearing performer. That shows speed is emotional at Circa. We also have audio described shows where you can book a headset and you'll be able to hear the descriptions of everything, all the visual elements of the show. Most of those also have a touch tour with them. For a couple, they don't, just because there isn't really anything to touch on stage. And then we also have some relaxed performances. So that's where nothing really changes about the performance itself, but what we try to make the environment as comfortable as possible for audience members. So,
and who's that geared for in the main, Helen?
So there's a number of people who might benefit from a relaxed performance. So, for example, people who struggle to sit still for a length of an hour-long show and need to move around a bit more, people who have any kind of verbal tics or anything like that, where anyone who has any of these things can come to any performance and they'll absolutely be welcome. It's just that in a relaxed performance, there's announcements beforehand so that everybody knows what's going on, everybody is on board. Also things like if you've got a young baby, a relaxed performance might be a really good option. If you know that you might need to leave during the performance, those kind of things. Just makes it a bit more of a comfortable environment for everyone.
How's it been going, Helen?
It's been going pretty well. We've had a few hiccups, as every festival does, whether it's access or any type of performance. But for the most part, it's been going really well. We have a really busy weekend coming up, the last weekend of the festival, where we've got an NZSL performance, where we've got a huge number of people coming in for that one. And we also have that is for 10,000 hours. And we also have for Music Portrait of a Humble Disabled Samoan. We've got huge access audiences coming in for those ones.
I know, I'm one of them.
You are, yes. We're looking forward to welcoming you for that.
And that's Helen Vivian Fletcher.
The Parable of the Old Man and the Young. So Abraham rose and clave the wood and went and took the fire with him and a knife. And as they sojourned, both of them together, Isaac, the firstborn, spake and said, My father, behold the preparations, fire and iron, but where the lamb for this burnt offering? Then Abraham bound the youth with belts and straps, and builded parapets and trenches there, and stretched forth the knife to slay his son, when, lo, an angel called him out of heaven, saying, Lay not thy hand upon the lad, neither do anything to him, thy son. Behold, caught in a thicket by its horns, a ram. Offer the ram of pride instead. But the old man would not so, but slew his son, and half the seed of Europe, one by one.
That's Sir Kenneth Branagh reading anti-war poet and soldier Wilfred Owen, and slew half of Europe's seed, one by one. That line alone shall put paid to notions of saving democracy or freedom, when all the evidence points to that war being motivated more by imperial ambition, from Britain to France, Germany and Russia, not to mention the Turks. This Anzac month, as we remember the fallen, let's spare a thought for those who didn't fall, but were badly injured, losing limbs, sight and hearing, as well as sanity. To explore this further, I'm joined in the studio by Disability Issues writers and commentators Robin Hunt and Wendy Wicks. So, Robin and Wendy, let's start with that exhibition at Te Papa of the people who had come back injured from the First World War. What was your impressions of it, your impressions?
Go, Robin.
Oh, well, it was in a tiny little room and it was quite obscurely placed and I kind of found it almost by accident, I think. And it was quite shocking. They were in the UK, but they were New Zealand soldiers. And it was very stark, their expressions. They looked exhausted, they looked angry, they didn't smile. And the title was The Disabled Soldier's Problem. And I naturally took some offence at that, given that they'd given up so much in a war for the greater good. And so it was interesting to see that this was an attempt at rehabilitation. They looked pretty rough. Their clothes were fairly rough. Their tools were pretty rudimentary, but they were being trained for trades. I couldn't read any of the accompanying labels, so I can't tell you that much about them. But it certainly struck me, and Te Papa talked about people being disfigured, and I was quite upset by that, and I think I wrote to them and complained and said that was not really helpful.
So what upset you about that description of being disfigured? Because some would say, well, they clearly were.
Well, I would say they were injured. Disfigured has very negative connotations. I would say they were injured.
And in terms of the injury, we're talking about what? Losing limbs?
Yep.
Burns?
Yep.
Being deaf or blind as a result of the artillery?
Yes.
What was your impression, Wendy?
I maybe wasn't quite so hassled, but that's not saying much because I was only a very short breathing distance behind Robin. What has struck me as I've reflected again on this, and I thought about it at the time, was how much more provision the British forces gave, the British Army. They had hospitals all over the place to, because that, I suppose there were industrial sizes of casualties, and they had it well set up. I looked up. They had some certainly specifically for Allied soldiers, but it seems to have been just everybody got a fair bit more, and if you compare it with the provision here, there was nothing here, nothing really. They were happy enough. The government of the time was happy enough, in a grudging sort of way, to provide disablement pensions, and they'd later on, with a bit of a fair bit of prodding, they gave re-establishment farms And they didn't call it rehabilitation as such. They called it repatriation all the time. But going back to the exhibition, they did look fairly angry, as though the, or despairing, as though they'd been given up. And I imagine that went on later too. There would be very few, like Oliver George, who managed to qualify in civil engineering after he'd lost an eye and a lot of his face. They would be the lucky ones, but your poor old ploddy private, like my granddad, he didn't get anything except a five-shilling pension after a thoroughly grudging review when he got home.
Yes, what struck me about the exhibition, when I'm thinking back to it, is the eyes.
Yeah.
Like, you see this gauntness and hollowness in the eyes, and I was thinking, I came across a phrase yesterday called the post-war psychological displacement. I thought that's exactly... But how much was that recognised at the time, by the way?
Almost certainly not.
I think they did talk about shell shock, but that was usually for the most extreme cases.
And many of them were weak, lily-livered sorts, weren't they?
Many of them, yes. Many of them were quite badly damaged and they couldn't settle. Like some of them, the ones that got some of the rehab farms, they weren't necessarily, they were often marginal land, and when the Depression came, they walked off, and that's why there were so many World War One veterans who were swaggies in the late 20s and 30s. And some of them were just, some of them I think became drunks and alcoholics as a way of dulling the pain and dealing with it, because it wasn't necessarily physical pain, it was... You know, it was psychological, and some of them were never the same after they came back.
I looked also at the Gillies archive, which has quite a lot of photos in them, and they had the eyes you mentioned, Mike. The
haunted.
They were there, but they weren't there.
They were haunted, a lot of them. I thought they looked haunted.
I imagine probably a fair few were.
Mm.
Mind you, didn't stop my grandfather being Jack the Lad and chasing around after women.
Well, I had a great uncle who put his age up to get in the First World War and his age down to get into the Second.
Yeah.
You got to wonder.
Gosh.
But just coming back to that, I mean, I wonder if these guys were thinking they're just getting me fixed up so they can send me right back again.
Yeah.
I wonder what motivations there were for rehabilitation such as it was. I guess someone was getting them fighting men back. Another might have been the obligation to serve the deserving poor of the deserving poor.
I think there was quite a lot of embarrassment, because up until then there hadn't been any rehabilitation of returned soldiers. They just had to get on as best they could. No state rehabilitation, I don't think. I don't know what the people coming back from the Boer War got, but there were a few, but not so many, of course, who went then. But I think that the rehabilitation would have been pretty paternalistic, as it was right up until after World War II.
What do you mean, after World War II?
Well, I'm thinking about the rehabilitation structures for soldiers, because now... Their rehabilitation is much more integrated into the health and rehab system, but they're still struggling to get rehab. Some of them, even the Vietnam War veterans, some of them still struggle to get acknowledgement.
Does it matter losing your legs? For people will always be kind, and you need not show that you mind when the others come in after hunting to gobble their muffins and eggs. Does it matter, losing your sight? There's such splendid work for the blind. And people will always be kind as you sit on the terrace, remembering and turning your face to the light. Do they matter, those dreams from the pit? You can drink and forget and be glad. And people won't say that you're mad, for they'll know that you fought for your country. And no one will worry a bit.
That's Tony Reid with another of the anti-war poets, Siegfried Sassoon. Yes, that reaction to the word disfigured, I wonder what's changed over the last, because I mean at the end of the 19th century, Margaret Tennant talks about the fact that people were often blamed for their own injury, like if you got drunk and had an accident, then that was your fault, whereas soldiers clearly were more deserving because they'd been fighting for the country.
I think people struggled, though. I think that they knew they couldn't be negative about them, but they still felt negatively about the injuries and the loss of function that the people might have had. I mean, even now, of course, you've got much better technology for things like amputees and so on, and you've got people from Afghanistan and the more recent wars who have got, you know, really gung-ho prosthetics, and they'll go off to the Invictus Games and they're fallen heroes. But I'm not so sure. I think there are probably a lot of people who have less visible scars and less visible difficulties like PTSD. I mean, we know what PTSD is now, but we didn't back then. And so I think there's still not probably enough recognition of that.
And they were returning as kind of an economic burden in at a time when the male was seen typically as the breadwinner. They couldn't be, and it was still up to the mother, often with children, to keep it together and try and, while the poor blokes who, often through no fault of their own, could not get any kind of work, they would feel guilty because they couldn't contribute. Some of them walked away because they couldn't deal with it. But that was why a lot of people, I think, they had that undercurrent there because it was known that they were likely to be a burden.
I think also the attitudes towards them have been a bit more ambivalent since, particularly for the Vietnam War, which was such a controversial war, and some of us, my generation, marched against that war. And so I think that a lot of the soldiers, when they came back, felt very unrecognised because of that.
I live not far from NARI, say, that has still some elderly members, including one. He has PTSD, but he also feels he's a Vietnam vet. He's got PTSD, and it's kind of like he avoids contact with people in case they blame him. One wonders how often that is happening still. And yes, we did march against them. It was wrong.
It was wrong. The war was wrong, you mean?
The war was wrong.
Yes, yes, yes.
People weren't, but the war was wrong.
Yes, yes. Yes, and I think there was also quite a lot of aggravation after World War II, because people were drafted into essential services. And my dad, because he was a contractor at the beginning of the war, and he had a lot of farming equipment like headers and all that sort of stuff, he was essential services and did a lot of work around the district for people while the men folk were away. And his eyes were damaged because in those days he worked long hours in dust and they didn't have the proper hearing protection or vision protection. So both his hearing and his sight were damaged as he got older, and that was probably as a result of not wearing enough safety gear when he was working. There was also a bit of he didn't go to the RSA, although he was invited, because I think he felt that some people thought he'd made money out of the war, which he didn't. He did a lot of work for nothing. But I think, you know, the wartime damage is quite huge because it damages families, it damages people who, you know, like the children and the spouses, because often the men came back and they were men who'd never been violent were violent when they came back because of their trauma, not because they were naturally violent people, but because they had been traumatised. So I think you often read memoirs of people who talk about their father being a different sort of man after the war and how it affected the family in negative ways.
Mm. I know my grandfather, getting back to World War One, my grandfather was much more irascible, particularly because he had shell in his face and every so often a piece of shrapnel would pop out of his eye. And that was preceded by great irascibility, probably going through quite a bit of pain. And he used alcohol to anaesthetise. One wonders just what part alcohol played in the rehabilitation or lack thereof of the World War One men.
It played a huge part. I had a great uncle who went to World War One, and while he seemed fine when he came back, and he was fine, but when he was dying, he was back in the trenches because it had probably been one of the most profound experiences of his life. But the alcohol, when I was quite young, we had some sort of guys to help my dad with things like milking the family cow and doing the garden and things like that. And we had two of them who were World War One veterans, and they were hopeless drunks. You know, they're poor men. They were probably just, they were alcoholics, obviously. And they couldn't even work half the time. They were either too drunk or too hungover to work. And it was terribly sad when you think of it, because my parents understood that that's what was going on. But, you know, they couldn't have them. And the third guy, he stayed with us for ages. He was lovely. He obviously was made of quite stern stuff. He didn't drink. And I suspect he had been a drinker, but he didn't drink, and he wouldn't talk about the war. He wouldn't go to any of the Anzac ceremonies. I think he'd had quite a tough life. I think he'd been to Borstal probably at some stage. So World War One might have been, obviously was traumatic for him too, but he dealt with it in a different way.
That's Robin Hunt wrapping up today's show, and with her you heard Wendy Wicks. My thanks to Tony Reid and Capity Gay Show for bringing us anti-war poets Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon. We'll go out with Eric Bogle live performing his classic and the band played Watching Matilda. Until next time, I'm Mike Gourley, looking forward to your company then. Ka kite anō.
Now when I was a young man, I carried me pack, and I lived the free life on the roller. From the Murray's green basin to the dusty outback, oh, I waltzed my Matilda all over. Then in 1915, my country said, son, it's time you stop rambling, there's work to be done. So they gave me a tin hat and they gave me a gun, and they marched me away to the war. And the band played Waltzing Matilda as the ship pulled away from the quay. And amidst all the cheers, the flag waving and tears, we sailed off for Gallipoli. How well I remember that terrible day, how our blood stained the sand and the water, and of how in that hell that they called Suva Bay, we were butchered like lambs at the slaughter. Johnny Turk, he was waiting, he primed himself well. He showered us with bullets and he rained us with shell. And in 5 minutes flat, he'd blown us all to hell. Nearly blew us right back to Australia. But the band played Waltzing Matilda when we stopped to bury our slain. We buried ours and the Turks buried theirs, and we started all over again. And those that were left, we tried to survive in that mad world of blood, death and fire. And for 10 weary weeks I kept myself alive, though around me the corpses piled higher. Then a big Turkish shell knocked me off over the head, and when I woke up in me hospital bed and saw what it had done, oh, I wished I was dead. Never knew there was worse things than dying. For I'll go no more waltzing Matilda. All around the green bush far and free, to hum tent and pegs, a man needs both legs. No more waltzing Matilda.
That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.